Hello. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Rajiv S. Khanna for immigration.com, the law office of Rajiv S. Khanna, PC. Today, this is a community conference call that we are addressing community-related issues in. Call is being recorded. Please make sure if you want to keep your identity confidential, do so if you ask any questions. This call will be made publicly available. I strongly recommend that you keep your identities confidential. By participating in this call, you have not become our client, nor we your lawyers. This is merely for community information purposes. That said, as usual, I will first answer the questions that have been posted, then any follow-up questions, then any new questions. First question I have is today is Savage J30, who wants to know, I understand that signing the I-864 is a very serious matter. I have also heard that the government can sue me. Can you give me some examples of what constitutes a breach of the I-864? Okay. I-864 is a contract between you, the person who's signing the I-864, and the government. The terms of the contract begin, I think, on page 6 of I-864. If you read that carefully, you should be able to understand a lot more about what you're signing into. Okay. Basically, the contract applies to those situations where the person you are sponsoring is applying for means-tested benefits. What are means-tested benefits? Those benefits which you get based upon how much money you make. So if a person applies for certain kinds of benefits, and the government, whether it's local, state, or federal, gives those benefits based upon how much money that person makes, those are means-tested benefits. The Form I-864 tells you what is not means-tested. Other than that, if you want a list of means-tested benefits, I don't think there is a comprehensive list. You would have to look at each benefit individually and see if it is means-tested or not. Okay. Before the government's local, state, or federal will give the benefit, they can count your assets as the sponsored person's assets and deny benefits. And if they do end up giving benefits, they can ask you to reimburse the government for those benefits. And if you don't, they can then sue you. Okay. Can the immigrant actually sue me? For example, if she divorces my brother, or thinks I do not give her enough money. Well, I haven't researched this issue specifically, although there is no contract between you and the immigrant. I'm quite sure there are some cases where people try to make it into a private contract and try to sue on Form I-864, especially in the domestic relations area, divorces, etc. But since I don't practice in that area, I don't know off the top of my head how did those cases ultimately turn out. Okay, so I really don't know what the success rate of a lawsuit like that is. I would be very surprised if courts allowed us to make a private contract out of an I-864. Okay. Next question is from R.K. Gupta about switching jobs on H-1B and retaining priority date. Very good. Green card filed prior to date of May 2009, been on H-1B since 2007 from India, currently working with the same employer, EAD-AP is in hand, waiting for PD to become current for GC. Okay. What options do I have for switching jobs on H-1B without losing priority date? I cannot do AC-21 because he wants to move to a completely different job. Excuse me. The way it works is to retain the priority date, you really don't have to do anything. The priority date is yours to keep as long as, this is the current thinking of the government, as long as they do not revoke the I-140 for fraud or misrepresentation. Even if the old employer withdraws or revokes your I-140, that does not take away your priority date. a couple of important things to remember in this context. Your priority date is transferable across categories, which you obviously know. So EB3 can be transferred to EB2 or EB1 and vice versa. And it is also, by that same token, transferable to different jobs. So you could go from being a database administrator to a vice president, you can still carry the same priority date. Okay. Now, the question that you asked me is, and also, of course, geographical location, you can be anywhere in USA. Is there any same similar constraint? The answer is no. If you are only aiming for a priority date, not for AC21 portability, there is no constraint of a same or similar job. Okay. Anything I should watch out for? Well, that depends upon your entire case. What kind of job are you going to? Are those people going to be able to show ability to pay wages? Do they have sufficient funds in their tax returns? So those are typically the things that I look for. Other than that, I mean, there's a whole list of reasons why a green card can be denied, and it's pretty much, I wouldn't say infinite, but indeterminate. There are so many things that can go wrong. I can't really list them all for you. Okay. Next question is M.U. Murulik. Murulik wants to know, can I come back to USA on F2? I am in India. I couldn't come back. I had an H1. So here's how I look at it. I saw that you said that your wife is doing a certificate program. Can I get an F2 on that? The way I look at it, as far as I know, in order for her to have an F1, she's obviously doing a full course of education. Okay, and if she's indeed doing that, you should be allowed to get an F2, no problem with that. If she can get an F1, you can get an F2. Okay, so that should, I think, in my view, should work. Now, the question is how much time is left on her F1. Let's see. Due to complete on 22nd May 2013. Well, you can try. I don't know how it is going to pan out. You can try. And since you have a question there about OPT, I believe she qualifies for OPT. Double check with the DSO of the school she's in. If she's been in status for as a full-time student for, I think it's 2 semesters, she's allowed to get her OPT, and she's not used it before. So double-check with the DSO. So that makes your case for an F2 even stronger, because the duration of the F2 is longer than just May, even though you're asking for F1 till May only for now. But eventually she'll go into OPT, and you can continue to be on F2. Okay. Rest of the information you have given me, I've already read through. So, oh yeah, you have a question about H1 cap. So, if you come back to USA, will I be under H1 cap? Okay. And second question is, should I get stamping done before starting work? Let's look at your situation. You came to USA in November 2007 on H-1B. Okay. 5 years later, you went back to India. That's August 2012. So one thing is for certain, you've not been outside USA for more than 1 year. Therefore, you're not subject to the quota as long as you return to USA before August 2013. Okay. So you may not have a lot of time left on your H-1, but you will not be subject to the quota. Next question you asked was, can I get an H-1 within USA? And the answer is sure. Certainly looks highly likely that's what will happen if it gets approved. It should be approved within USA because you would be in valid F-2 status and you're converting from F-2 to H-4. Next question is from Kiran, who says his handle is L1BTOL1A. L1B2L1A, I guess that's what he's saying. L1B2L1A. So he's been working for a company A on visa L1B from 2007 to 2012. then changed from L1B to H1B through another company. Valid till October 2013, but I did not join that company. Later, Company A, his current employer, changed status from L1B to L1A, effective from October 2012. One issue here, Kiran, make sure you were never out of status, because if you were approved with a change of status, then somewhere in between there, you worked illegally on L1. I'm not sure that's your circumstance, but if that indeed is, you want to have your lawyers take a quick look at it. See how that plays out with the L1A conversion, etc. So you have a plan to do an EB1C, International Manager Green Card, but I don't know whether my company A is qualified for EB1. Well, the company's qualifications, I don't know if they can get you an L1A. Certainly, the company itself can qualify for EB1, in my view, it looks like it. I want to start my green card process with EB2, master's degree plus 5 years U.S. experience, using Company C, who are ready to start my green card process in May. Company C is a young company, 4 employees, 400,000 income. Can I start perm with Company C? Well, a couple of issues here. One issue is, when perm first came out, if you look at the form 9089, there's a question, and it looks like, I think the question refers to company with less than 10 employees. It asks you something like that. So we were all on the immigration bar side, we were all of the opinion that companies with less than 10 employees will probably have a tougher time getting perm approvals than companies that are larger. But it didn't work out like that. We've done cases for companies as small as 1 employee companies and have not had any degree of difficulty more than we have in normal cases. So just the fact that the company is small, I'm not concerned, but their tax returns have to be examined. Okay. See, ability to pay wages simply means this. According to USCIS, except if you're in Seventh Circuit where you can argue other things, USCIS wants to look at the company's tax returns going from the date the perm was filed to the date you actually get your green card. They can look at all that. Typically, they look at only the year perm was filed. They look at the tax return. They look at the next net taxable income. Does the company have money? And then if there's not enough money there to pay your salary, they'll look at the net current assets, Schedule L, of the tax return. Okay. This is a long term. I mean, I would have to look at the tax returns, or your lawyers would have to look at the tax returns to decide whether or not the company is capable of paying wages. If the job is bona fide, good faith, honest job offer, and if the company is making enough money, I don't see any problem applying through them. In case if I get perm and my I-140 before my L1A expires, can I extend my H-1B for 3 more years? To the best of my knowledge, you should be able to. I don't see why not. Can I extend my H-1B even if the H-1B expires when I will be on valid L1A? See, this is a tricky issue. I'm not sure I know the answer to that. So the question is this. I am on L1A. Seventh year of my L1A expires. Can I now get 3-year H-1B extension because my I-140 is approved? I don't know. I'll have to look at the law very carefully, look at some of the memoranda, because, of course, if you are on H-1 already and your time expires, you can keep getting H-1 extensions, including the 3-year once the I-140 is approved, that extension that you're talking about. But can you also take advantage of going into H-1 status for 3 years if L1A 7 years expire? I don't know. I don't think anybody knows the answer to that question. My guess, this is a guess, underscore that, guess, is that you should be able to. Okay. But if you want to be safe, then convert to H-1B before your time runs out, so that then if the I-140 gets approved, beyond question, you will be entitled to a 3-year H-1 extension. Next question is from Sikandar. green card application followed by tourist visa application and vice versa. I'm a U.S. citizen, want to apply for green card for my parents. So the question is, if I'm a U.S. citizen, I apply for green card for my parents. There are two ways I can do that. Outside USA, when they are still outside USA. And second, if they are inside USA visiting, and I convert them to green card. And then they give me a link to my blog, which was August 13, 2009, on this topic. And the answer, it's right here. That link is right here in case you're interested to see. So the answer is yes. That's still good law. There is no change in the laws in that respect. If they have a green card pending, their entry on tourist visa can be denied. I hope that CBP is not so incredibly and unreasonably tough on, you know, older people, parents of a U.S. citizen, that they would turn them away at the airport, but they can. Okay. Second problem, if they enter USA using tourist visa with an intention to convert to green card, that can become a problem. We are right now dealing with a case where some very unreasonable circumstances exist. USCIS is claiming that when the beneficiary, who's the wife of a U.S. citizen, entered USA as a visa waiver, kind of a B-1, B-2 person, she lied because it was her intention to get married. That's not a very usual situation. There are a couple of other complications in the case. But they have made that into one of the points of contention. So be mindful. I don't like the idea of entering USA with a preconceived intention. I have never liked it. The government does not usually make an issue of it. In fact, I had a consultation with one of our existing clients today. They have a similar issue, but they were quite sure that they were not going to convert to green card, but then while they were here, their son got his citizenship, his naturalization. So it depends upon the circumstances of an individual case, but certainly they can make an issue. To answer your questions in brief, if they have a green card pending, their tourist visa can be denied, and their entry on tourist visa can be denied, both. But their green card application is not canceled just because they've applied for a tourist visa. That's not a problem. And two, if they enter USA on a tourist visa and try to convert to a green card, they can be asked about their intention. And this is much more so if they apply within, let's say, 60 days of entry for a green card. Okay. By the way, Sikandar, I like your SIG line. It says, always eat dessert first. I completely agree. Next question is IMQ7. Currently on L1B, expiring June 2013. Spouse is on L2 EAD. Expires the same day. I intend to apply for E2. So the question is there any way she can continue working while the L1 to E2 goes on? Because even under E2, she gets an EAD. She gets an employment authorization. The question is, I'm on L1. I want to convert to E2. Is there any way my spouse can continue working while that L1 to E2 changeover is going on? I'm trying to think what could be the way to make that happen. Because the moment you convert to E2, she should not be working anymore because she's no longer on L2. And one of the scenarios you've raised is, should I do a change of status? That might be something worth trying. And I'm pretty sure E2, you can do premium processing. The question is, if you do E2, and this is something I'll have to check with our team members, I think you can file the E2 EAD request at the same time as the E2. Okay. Why don't you give the U.S. customer service a call? I know that they're not very reliable in many things, but the frontline staff if they're not able to answer that question, they might be inclined to put you in touch with an adjudications officer at USCIS who might give you better information. So the question you want to ask them is this. If I apply for E2, can I apply for the EAD at the same time for me and my wife? Second, do you adjudicate the EADs at the same time as you adjudicate the E2 application? I doubt it, but worth asking. Number three, if I file at premium processing, would you then adjudicate both my applications, E2 and EAD, simultaneously? Again, I doubt it. I don't think there is a foolproof way of ensuring non-interruption other than her getting a separate status like an H-1B for herself. Okay. Next question is from Prakash, who says, derivative spouse 485 is pending. Very nicely summed up, thank you. Derivative spouse 485 pending, primary received citizenship. Will USCIS deny her application? Yes. Yes. You should convert. What you should do is immediately file I-130 for her and request USCIS to take that I-130 and put it on top of her existing employment-based derivative, I-485. Okay. File I-130 as the spouse of a U.S. citizen and immediately request at the same time that they attach the 485 to your application. That should work. And the last question today was something about the requirements for acceptable photographs in UK. I'm sorry, I have no idea. And we cannot move these comments, individual comments, from place to place. Sorry. Okay. Now, if anybody has any follow-up questions on what we have discussed so far, please press 5-star on your phone. 5-star. One question. Okay, very good.
Let's see. Area code 207. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Mike. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you. My question is, it was regarding the second last question you read about from L2 EAD to E2 EAD. And you mentioned that either we could call the adjudication office and check.
One moment, ma'am. I think I
hello?
Yeah, please.
My follow-up question is that would it be possible, instead of moving from L1 to E2, if I were to do L1B to L1A, which I'm eligible for also, would then the EAD be able to continue from L1B to L1A? Because I do get 3 more years on L1A if I go on L1A instead of continuing as renewal on L1B.
L1B to L1A can be done under certain circumstances.
Right.
And L1A is for 2 extra years, not for 3 extra years. So you get 7 years on L1A and 5 years on L1B. Now, I think your question is this, ma'am, that can your husband continue to work on his EAD if you go from L1B to L1A? To the best of my knowledge, yes. But again, this is not something that's written down in any books. It will be a good idea to double-check this with USCIS. And who you want to call is not the adjudications officer directly. You'll call USCIS customer service, and you will explain to them your question. If they're not able to answer it, typically they will themselves get an adjudications officer on the line.
Okay.
So in my view, if you go from L1B to L1A, your husband can continue using his EAD as far as I know, because it's still L1 status. But I cannot confirm 100% that's the way it works, nor can I refer you to any legal source that says that. I think what you should do is, like I said, these are questions that are very, very fine-grained. You may want to call USCIS customer service and see if you can get a response. If you don't, just come back to me in 2 weeks and we'll toss this around a little bit more.
Okay, thank you so much for your help.
You're welcome. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, folks, anybody has any questions, press 5-star on your phone. Five star if anyone has any questions. One question. Okay. So this is the last question of the day. That gives me some time to probably read up on the new law and proposed law and make a video of that. I had promised somebody I'll do that. Area code 773. Go ahead, please. What is your question?
Hello, Rajiv. My name is Muzamil. Just wanted to have one question. Like, I have EAD and advanced payroll, and my 485 is pending since 2007 and when we got current, actually. I hope you remember that thing. But at that time...
You mean 2007,
yeah.
Everybody became current all of a sudden?
Right, right. At that time, I got the EAD and advance payroll, but my wife was in India, and she was not able to get. And then after later on, she came, and she's still on H-4 visa.
Okay.
And like recently, you know, like a couple of years back, we applied for EAD and advance payroll for her, and USCIS got. Approved EAD and advance parole for her. And later on, like after 1 year, they denied EAD and advance parole because saying the reason is she was not current, but you applied, then, you know, ultimately they rejected the application. So, means later on after 1 year, I thought that H-1 was, you know, not necessary, so I was working on EAD and she was also on EAD, so... But ultimately, this denial come, and then I was very, you know, surprised over the denial. But she has to leave the country, and she left to India. And then because if I want to get her, then I need the H-1 again.
That is correct.
So, yeah, so my company has applied the H-1 and got approved. So I'm planning to go to India and get it stamped. So
let me stop you for a second. Let me stop you for a second. Is there a reason you're not going to Canada to get it stamped?
No, I'm just going India directly for a stamping.
You may
because she is also in India right now.
You may want to consider just applying from Canada. It's maybe a little bit easier. Are you working at an end client or are you working in-house for a company?
Means a consulting company through a client.
Yeah, so I think you may want to think about maybe applying through Canada. Not that it's going to be definitely easier, but maybe a little bit easier. So keep going. What are the questions you have?
So, like, I'm just worried, like, you know, if the consulate people ask about what's going on with her and what's, like, denial, is there any issue on that part?
I have not looked at the details of the case. The only thing I would recommend is have your lawyers look at her case, make sure that there was no unlawful presence of 180 days or more. As long as there was no unlawful presence, I don't see any problem. You filed a 485 for her thinking it was okay to do that. Later on, it turned out it wasn't. Well, you made a mistake, but so did the government. They sat on that application for so long, you thought it was okay. So, personally, any of this cannot be used by the consulate to decline you, your H-1. I don't see how they can use this.
Okay. And, like, in case if they do it, like, can I able to come on advance parole by myself? Because my advance parole is valid, and, you know, like, if they have any issues in getting in issuing the H-1, then will I able to come on advance parole, or they will cancel my advance parole also?
No, they don't have the authority to cancel the advance parole. In my view, you will be able to come back on the advance parole.
Okay, if something going on in H-1 stamping.
Yes. I don't see how they can stop you from coming back on advance parole.
So, like, your suggestion is to go to Canada and get it stamped, and then you can send the H-4 for my wife, you mean?
Yeah, it might be a little easier. Not necessarily. I know one guy who's stuck in Canada for a couple of months now.
Mm-hmm.
that were to happen, you can always say, I withdraw my application, I'm going to apply in India. Okay?
Okay.
And that doesn't make your case any more difficult than it already is. Problem is, whenever you have end client placement, we just don't know how the consulates are going to behave. The saddest thing is, you know, employer has spent $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 on getting the H-1 approval, government fees, attorney fees, this, that. And then consulate comes back with, after quote-unquote investigating for 6 months and say, this is the typical response I have seen, and this makes me want to, you know, really sue these people because this is so wrong at several levels. They'll say, it appears that your employer in USA is either unwilling or unable to offer you a job. That is singularly uninformative. That does not tell us anything what the reason for denial is.
Okay.
And consulates have used that. We have brought that to the attention of the Visa Center. We brought it to the attention of the Presidential Council, Advisory Council, people who advise the President. They have not changed their ways. Okay.
Okay.
That's what I'm concerned about. You go to India, I don't know. I mean, you may be one of the lucky ones who gets his visa stamping without any problem, but there's no way we can ever be sure how it's going to turn out there.
Okay. Yeah, the reason she left in India because she was getting out of status, so that's the reason she left India the moment EAD and advance parole got a denial.
No, that I can understand, but I don't see how that will affect your H-1 issuance. I don't see any problem.
Okay. So, like, if they ask anything about the denial, so we have to explain it clearly, right, on that one?
Absolutely. If they ask you a question, you answer truthfully. If they don't ask, don't answer.
Okay. All right, Roger. Thank you so much for your advice on this.
You're welcome. Good luck, sir.
Okay. All right. Thank you again.
Okay. All right, guys. Anybody has any questions? 5-star on your phone? Very well. It doesn't look like we have any more questions. I'm going to go ahead and terminate this call. Oops. Oh. Wow. 2 more questions at the last minute? Okay, very well. No problem. This one is from India, I think. Go ahead.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Rajivji. I just spoke to you in the morning. I had just one more thing. If the research fellowship persons, can they? They offered me research fellowship in one of the institutes in Boston.
I remember talking.
And can they? Can they sponsor H-1B for me if I'm paid from India?
No. The way H-1Bs work is this. It has to be a U.S. employer, and they have to pay you the salary. Okay. It can't be that you are self-funding and then that is getting paid to you as a salary, and even though it's coming from another source, the U.S. employer can claim it as sufficiently compliant of the law. I mean, it's another thing. If the U.S. employer gets some kind of a grant from an Indian company and then at the same time they are paying your salary, that's fine. But I'm a little concerned that USCIS doesn't view this as some kind of a misrepresentation. I think what I would want to do is, if indeed that can be worked out, that the company that wants to sponsor you, your visit to USA, will pay the employer, and the employer will pay your salary. If it is indeed done that way, first of all, I don't think it will work out. I don't think the university will accept that fund. But let's say if they do accept it, then when they file the H-1, I think they should make it clear in the paperwork that this is what they are doing, so that tomorrow government cannot come back and say that you lied to us and you committed fraud upon us. It's not possible that H-1B is done by university and the money is coming from someplace else directly in your hands. Money has to come from...
Will I be eligible? Okay. Sorry.
Okay.
Hello. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you, sir. Will I be eligible for any other visa type?
No, I've looked at your...
Except the J-1?
No, I don't see any other way to do what you're planning to do. There is no other visa that I can think of.
Okay.
J-1 was the only choice that we talked about. Okay?
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Okay, last question of the day, area code 732. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Right now I'm on hedge fund and then planning to go to Canada and then come back to U.S. on visitor visa because I do have a valid visitor visa. If I do that, what will happen to my dependent H4 wife visa status?
If you are not on H1, she is not on H4. Very simple.
Okay. How long I can be on H1 without a job or payroll running?
Not even one day.
Okay.
The bill that I'm looking at, what is that immigration reform bill that Chuck Schumer and a bunch of other people have provided copies of, that does contain a 60-day provision. I'll talk a lot more about that over the next couple of days. But right now, under the current law, there is not even a single day grace period if an employee loses their job. But you may want to look at my blog. There is an entry on if you do a search, advanced search on my blog for the words laid off, two different words, laid off. You should be able to pull out that entry. It talks in detail about applying for a tourist visa within USA, both for you and your wife, while you, look for another job.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
You need to review it very carefully. I've got a lot of material on this subject. And why don't you come back in a couple of weeks once you've reviewed all these things, and if you have any specific questions, I'll answer them for you.
All right, Ajay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Okay. All right, guys. Are we really done this time? 5-star, any other questions? Okay. It looks like we are done. Thank you for being here, and I will see you in a couple of weeks.